Hello and welcome to NewsHour. It's coming to you live from the BBC World Service studios in London. I'm Tim Franks. And we're beginning in the United States because we all know that we're on the cusp of something very big, the country's decision whether it and the world will have 4 more years of Donald Trump or 4 years of Kamala Harris in charge. But that feels, to be honest, like the limit of our knowledge. All the signals are that the race is unreadably tight. Although, of course, those signals, those polls could also be wrong. So we'll try to work out in a few minutes why this seems such a confoundingly difficult election to predict. First, though, let's hear from one of those battleground states, as we tend to call them, the handful of swing states, which, should they tilt by maybe just a few thousand votes one way or the other, could hand Harris or Trump the key Electoral College numbers to take them to the White House. And perhaps the most prized swing state is Pennsylvania. The BBC's Justin Webb is there, and you will have to forgive his opening clanking cliché, because like a foreign reporter drawn to bagpipes in Scotland or accordions in Paris, so Webb has felt the need to begin in Philadelphia rhapsodising over cheese steaks.
We're outside Pat's King of Steaks. They invented the prototype of beefsteak sandwiches that uses an Italian-style roll and seasonings. Just to give you a sense of what they are selecting for their lunch, one of them called the Originator, but another called the Heart Attack.
Here's your pepper, cheese and onions.
I am Frank Enrico Oliveri. I am the fourth generation owner of the world famous Pat's King of Steaks in South Philadelphia. Former President Donald Trump was here. We got the word that he was coming the day before, and there was really nothing we could do to stop him.
Well, of course, my mother's a Trumpster. She's delusional.
Don't even let me say it.
We look over politics.
We don't have a choice.
We're choiceless.
We don't have a choice.
Do you ever talk about politics?
No, we don't. It's his prerogative who he votes for. It's my prerogative who I vote for.
We're here on this street with people, ordinary people walking past in a part of town where there isn't a lot of money. Do you hear from your own customers?
Customers are concerned about the prices of things. Do you think that Joe Biden and Kamala Harris are responsible for higher grocery prices and oil prices? Or do you think that Donald Trump's responsible for those higher prices? Or do you think the previous administration to that's responsible? Yeah, you know what? They all are.
We are in the kitchen,
and it's all stainless steel, and there's a lot going on. It's busy. Tell me about costs.
The meat's gone up probably like 25 to 35% since the pandemic. When our rolls have gone up maybe 35%, 40%.
And what's that done to the prices you charge people?
Unfortunately, we have to pass the prices along to our customers now.
But it's those costs, it's those extra costs that are hurting Kamala Harris, isn't it? Because they associate the inflation with this administration, and she's a part of the administration.
Yeah, she's a part of the administration, absolutely. And everybody associates what's wrong with the current administration and totally forgets about what the previous administration did to cause what's going on in this administration.
Righty ho, we come out from the kitchen, out to the red benches, very basic red benches outside. And let's talk to some diners. We're talking to people about the election, not necessarily who you're voting for, but what you think the issues are. You can tell us.
We are from Boston,
right?
Here volunteering for the Harris campaign for the next week. So we're excited. We start the door knocking and phone calls and whatever they want us to do tomorrow through Election Day.
Looking at the streets around here where people are living lives that are kind of paycheck to paycheck.
Yeah.
What are the issues they bring up with you?
The economy. It has to be. It's number one. I do know every time we talk to a Trump supporter, they say it's immigration. So when you're looking around, you see these diverse neighborhoods. It's always shocking that people are voting for Trump when, in fact, it's going to probably affect them more than anybody else.
Ladies, I'll let you get on with your steak. Thank you.
Thank you.
You got a view that you'll share with us?
Very simple. I hate the professional political class in this country. They don't have any real-world experience. The only thing they care about is getting elected, getting re-elected, amassing power, maintaining that power, and getting elected again.
So if you believe those things, who do you vote for?
I vote for Trump, because he's coming from the real world.
Here's the thing about Pennsylvania. No Democratic presidential nominee has won the White House without winning this state since 1948. It is a must-win for Kamala Harris. And to win this state, she has to win this city, Philadelphia, by a huge blowout margin. Can she do it? We've come outside the center of the city now to a suburb, a trendy suburb. It's Fishtown. It's a very democratic area in its politics. A lot of young families living here, and among them, Julia Taruso, who is the political reporter for the Philadelphia Inquirer.
For a long, long time, the way you won as a Democrat in Pennsylvania was to drive turnout up in Philadelphia, get all your voters out there and in Pittsburgh and some of the suburbs, and a Democrat could win Pennsylvania.
And in Philadelphia, how has she done? How is she doing?
I was with her just this past weekend. She went to church in a very black part of West Philadelphia. She went to a barber shop. She went to a Puerto Rican restaurant. She's really tried to focus on the parts of the city that often have lower turnout.
What is it that hasn't cut through to those communities she ought to be cutting through to? Is it possible to say what it is?
Well, in Philadelphia specifically, we are still, unfortunately, the poorest big city in America. So nationally, the big issue in this campaign is the economy, and in Philadelphia and in Pennsylvania, that's the case for voters, too.
And Donald Trump is aware of that. Has he been working? I mean, you've made it plain, this city is a Democratic city, but has the Trump campaign in Philadelphia been trying to just pull away enough voters who would in the past have voted Democratic to make the crucial difference?
The Trump campaign has had the biggest footprint in Philadelphia that a Republican campaign has had in years and years and years. Now, that's not to say he's here all the time. He did one big rally here over the summer. It's not as big as the Democrats by any means, but they are here. You know, I think the hope for them is that even if some of those voters don't come out and vote for Trump, they might stay home, and that helps Trump here.
We've hopped in a car now to cross Philadelphia to go to one of the few areas of the city that you can honestly say is a Republican stronghold. And the reason we're going there is to hear from Republicans themselves about the degree of confidence they have that Trump really is doing some business in this city that'll make a difference.
My name's Joseph Accavino.
And you're going to be a Trump voter?
Yes, sir.
You've got a Trump cap on?
Yep, Trump Vance.
Why?
The economy, the way people are feeling, the way everything is. Most people, you know, can't afford to live right now. Can't afford rent, can't afford gas, can't afford the food you eat, the clothes you put on your back, you know. 2016, the economy was well under Trump. Biden came in, Harris came in, crushed it, highest inflation rate, destroyed everything, and then now, you know, Trump's going to have to come back in and fix what Harris and Biden failed to do.
Josh Novotny, I'm a partner at SBL Strategies, which is a lobbying firm based out of D.C., but I live in Philadelphia, and I'm a local ward leader and involved with politics. The neighborhood's called Packer Park. It's one of the few wards in Philadelphia that actually has a Republican majority for most elections.
And how's it doing as a campaign place for you this time around?
Yeah, it's actually a hotbed for Trump. It is extremely lively for Trump, enthusiastic, and we have tons of early data showing it's going to be heavy turnouts.
So this city, we keep coming back to this city. Yeah. She's going to win this city.
She'll win
but,
the city.
But your point is, by how much?
Correct. So an old campaign hat like myself, who's been in a few statewide Pennsylvania war rooms on election night, the first county to come in, for the most part, is Philadelphia. And it's a gut punch for Republicans. You're down 400,000 or 500,000 votes to start off the evening. Now, if you can shave that down by 20, 30, 40,000 votes, that makes the rest of the night a lot easier.
20, 30, 40, I mean, it's not many votes, is it?
No. And when you think he won the state by 30 or 40,000. No, I think it was less than that in 2016, and he lost by a little bit over 80,000 in 2020.
And this huge nation with whatever it is now, 340 million people in it, actually really coming down to tens of thousands of people in this one city.
Yeah, in probably the ward we're in right now.
And that was Justin Webb reporting from Philadelphia in Pennsylvania. Kathy Frankovic is a U.S. pollster. She's a consultant with YouGov America, formerly director of surveys at CBS News. Everybody is saying that the polls are tight. How confident can we be that they're right?
Well, I think there are things to consider that could make it less tight. Number one is if there is a last-minute surge over the weekend, we have a few more days. Number two is how much of the vote is cast already. And I have to underscore this. 59 million people have already voted. This is as of yesterday. And there are still several days left of early voting and time for people to get their absentee mail ballots in. So whatever happens over the weekend, while it can affect some people, is not going to affect those people who've cast a ballot already. And that's probably more than a third of the total number of ballots that will be cast.
Mm. Do you get a sense that, I mean, you know, we always tend to talk about the importance of turnout in elections, but actually that turnout really could be the key thing here, because it's not just about people sort of deciding who they're going to vote for, but deciding whether they're going to vote.
That's true. The polls suggest that it's only a tiny fraction of the electorate, perhaps 3%, that is not saying whom they will vote for at this point in time. But those 3% could make the difference in the critical battleground states. As I'm sure you all know, we think that we know what's going to happen in most of the country, and it's seven states where no one's quite sure who's going to win.
Sure. But given that, do you get a sense whether there is more, in a sense, more enthusiasm among Harris supporters or Trump supporters, Republicans or Democrats, to actually turn their sort of vague preferences into an effort to either cast their ballot early or you know, go on Tuesday to a polling station?
Well, the latest Gallup poll actually says that there's more enthusiasm among Harris voters than there is among Trump voters. That's a change from some previous elections, and a change from what we were seeing in the polls before Joe Biden left the race and Harris became the Democrats' nominee. So there is enthusiasm on the side of Harris. Now, the question is, of course, where are those enthusiastic voters? Are they in states like New York that are going to go Democratic anyway, or are they in the critical states like Pennsylvania?
Right. And that is the absolutely key point, isn't it, that we need to keep on reminding people, is that it's not about the popular vote. It is about this strange beast called the Electoral College. And
I like that term, strange beast. Yes.
And is it reasonable to say that the best guess is that the Electoral College favors Donald Trump a bit?
Well, that is because the Senate, every state gets two electoral college votes because they have two senators. And there are huge differences in the population state by state. So it turns out that some of those larger Western rural states vote Republican. So there's a slight benefit to any Republican candidate when the electoral college vote is counted.
Kathy Frankovic, a consultant with the polling outfit YouGov America. You're listening to NewsHour live from the BBC. This is NewsHour live from the BBC with me, Tim Franks. We began with all the unpredictability of the US election. One election which has just ended with a result, and a very striking result, is Botswana. And that's because the governing party has been defeated after nearly 60 years in charge of this small southern African country. Indeed, the outgoing president, Mokgweetsi Masisi, had the humility to say that his Botswana Democratic Party had got it wrong big time. Here's part of his concession speech.
I wish to congratulate the opposition on their victory and concede the elections. I am proud of our democratic processes, and I respect the will of the people.
The country's next president is likely to be the human rights lawyer Duma Boko from the opposition Umbrella for Democratic Change. Nomsa Maseko is the BBC's Southern Africa correspondent. What did it for the ruling party?
The downfall of the ruling party was brought on by socio-economic issues, which have been mounting for quite a while now, and specifically youth unemployment, which currently stands at 28%, and also the fact that the governing party had been struggling to pay social grants and also to increase the minimum wage. Those are the issues that, you know, the more than a million voters who went to the polls on Wednesday were, you know, complaining about. At the same time, this also shows that, you know, this is definitely marking the end of 50 years of rule for the party, which has been in charge since independence in 1966.
Yeah. Do you think that we can draw any sort of broader conclusions for the region about, you know, just how, obviously, given that this is a relatively young electorate and that it, by that definition, they weren't around when this party first came to power, and maybe sort of think that they have less to be grateful for their role in the liberation from colonial rule and all the rest of it, that is a bit of a trend among Southern African countries.
Well, that's what political veterans will tell you, and say that the young people who are the majority of voters in these countries are ungrateful because of the fact that of the things that had to be done and compromised during that time, the colonial time to the switch of democracy. But if you also look at how South Africa, the elections ended in May of this year, the ANC lost power for the first time in 30 years. The ANC had to form a coalition government, to stay in power. But also the elections that are also going to be taking place later this month in Namibia, it's going to be a tight election. It could see the ruling party, which has been in power since 1990, possibly going out of office.
I suppose one thing that is striking about this result is the grace with which the man who had been in charge said, we got it wrong. Congratulations to our opponents.
Absolutely. And also Duma Boko, who is now going to become the president of the country. This is his third time lucky, because he did, run against the former president, Ian Khama, and 5 years ago also against Mokgweetsi Mosisi. And, a third time lucky for him, the human rights lawyer, Duma Boko. We are expecting actually to speak to him on BBC later on today after his high-level meetings that are currently taking place.
Nomsa Maseko, Southern Africa correspondent, on a big result in Botswana. Probably won't surprise you to hear that cutting down on sugar can be good for your health. But a new study suggests that doing so right at the start of a child's life could have a big impact on their future long-term health. Researchers at the University of Southern California analysed the impact of ending sugar rationing in the United Kingdom after the Second World War, and say that reducing sugar in a child's first 1,000 days from conception to the age of 2 appears to lower their risk of major diseases later in life. Professor Steve Turner is president of the Royal College of Paediatrics and Child Health in the United Kingdom.
This is really important research. This, to an extent, isn't a surprise, and just builds on what is an increasingly robust level of evidence that we need to take care and consideration of children from conception. In the old days, I went to medical school in the 90s and was taught that the fetus was protected. It was in a privileged position. It couldn't come to harm from its environment. But we now know that that's not true. This study is just another example of one exposure that fetuses can experience that might well be associated with lifelong implications for health and well-being.
And I mean, yes, you're absolutely right. There are sort of interesting parts to this, but I guess that was one of the more grabby, was that, you know, we know that pregnant women should avoid smoking. Everybody should avoid smoking and should avoid alcohol. But the idea that perhaps they also need to think about their sugar intake, I imagine, will set quite a few minds racing.
Well, no, I mean, I can reassure people that the key to health and well-being is quite simple. It's a healthy, balanced diet, regular exercise, not smoking, and ideally not drinking. So for women who are pregnant, as long as they follow the standard guidelines for what you're allowed to eat, and I'm not sure what you're not allowed to eat these days, but there are a few additions, but they are absolutely allowed to have a bit of sugar in their tea. What we're talking about here is food items, usually which come in a package, which have got a huge amount of refined sugar. That's what we're really talking about.
And I guess also that that's something that a lot of exhausted new parents often reach for, because it's easy.
Yeah, absolutely. And you're not wrong. I've got four children. My youngest is 19, so it's a while ago. But I do vaguely remember those days, and it is hard work. But if you look at baby, the pouches that you can get, and they've got brightly coloured on them, and they're natural sugars, and they're but actually, the British Dental Association did some work on them. They found that some of these pouches have got more sugar in them than a can of any cola brand. And there was one that had more than 2/3 of an adult's daily sugar requirement. Oh, in a single one. And I know we're speaking to a global audience, but this isn't just a UK thing. You know that the food industry is equally active in many, many nations across the world, and isn't regulated. So parents are obviously aware of what's happening to their child. And as you say, they're sometimes a little bit tired. But just have a look at the amount of sugar in the baby food before you put it in your child, because I think you'd be unpleasantly surprised at how much refined sugar is in there. We were designed and evolved to eat, you know, fruit, basic things that were put together, mulched and mashed. And that's still true. Even if we're now in an environment where you can get all of these fancy things in a pouch, we're not really designed and evolved to do that. And too much of it is harmful to us.
Sage advice from Professor Steve Turner, President of the Royal College of Paediatrics and Child Health. There is more about this study on our website, bbc.com/news. You can head for the health pages. There's a piece there from James Gallagher, one of our health correspondents. It also, in a bonus way, includes a very fetching black and white photo of three kids eating veg on a stick, a wartime snack from 1941. I'm sure there are other snack options that are healthy that are available these days. You're listening to NewsHour. Welcome back to NewsHour. And that's not our new signature tune, sadly. Or it could be a contender, but it is the theme tune, as I'm sure many of you know, to Hello Kitty, the Japanese animated sensation who today celebrates her 50th birthday. She is, for the uninitiated, a cat-like personality, universally described as cute. And when I say universal, her image does appear the world over, not just on screens, but on merchandise. Leslie Bowe is a professor of English and Asian American Studies at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. How does she explain the kitty sensation?
I think that, you know, when you go back to the origins of Hello Kitty in the 1970s for the company Sanrio, you know, she started out as just a very simple line drawing that decorated stationery. And then all of a sudden you have this global phenomenon of what's called kawaii or cute style that has really taken over the world.
And you say you've translated kawaii as cute style. It does have a certain power, doesn't it?
Absolutely. I mean, this is an aesthetic form that is really about creating a certain type of feeling, right? So we can experience the sublime or the beautiful or wabi-sabi, to name another Japanese aesthetic. But this particular one actually stimulates what you would call maternal feelings of protectiveness. So cute things are generally small, right? They're animals or objects or babies. They have a very rounded shape. And the idea is that kwaii or cute things actually stimulate not only the idea of sparking joy, but a sense of protectedness, right? They make you happy, but in turn, you want to take care of them.
I see. And I have to say, I came to this slightly undercooked in terms of the Hello Kitty culture. But I have been reading that Hello Kitty is also spawned, I mean, as part of the stable of characters. There are some with sort of slightly harder edges. I mean, those who channel the sort of frustrations and maybe even sort of inner rage that modern life sometimes stokes up in us.
Right. And I think, you know, for me, what's most interesting about this phenomena of cuteness is that there is a dark side to cute. You know, so the first, you know, part of it is what you're mentioning, and it's a kind of ironic consumption of kwaii characters where people really identify with the idea of cuteness and then the desire to push out of it. But also the idea of the dark side of cute really is about, you know, dominating cute things.
The dark side of cute. Leslie Bow, Professor of English and Asian American Studies at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, talking about the 50th birthday of Hello Kitty. This is NewsHour. It's live from the BBC, and I'm Tim Franks. It has been an agonising week for Spain, the flash floods in the southeast of the country killing, it's just been announced, at least 205 people and devastating great swathes of land. After the scramble to rescue those who were caught in the swirling, muddy torrents, now the effort is directed towards restoring mains water and communications for hundreds of thousands. That, and just trying to clear up the enormous, claggy mess that's been left by the trails of destruction. An informal army of thousands of volunteers carrying rakes and shovels have joined the military and emergency services. This young woman spoke to the BBC on a street in the town of Valencia as she helped to clear the mud.
My family is just 200 meters away from the flood, and we are just helping our neighbors. This is devastating, seeing everyone that lost their houses and everything, and it's the least we can do. Just do stuff. Anything is helping.
Aurora Iglesias is also in Valencia, and she is doing what she can to try and help marshal those volunteer resources. This is what she had to tell me.
Immediately the morning when I woke up, I knew that there was going to be a big need of support in the community. I know a lot of people that would want to come together and find a way to help. And so right away, I opened the group Valencia Together to volunteers and support. And the idea was to gather the people that wanted to come in as a community to help the cause and also to bring in the information. So what I started doing was just scouting anything that needed to be done in the city and started to post in the Facebook group. And it quickly grew.
Yeah, I mean, and I've seen, I don't know if this was the product of your work, but I've seen online some very affecting video of these people. I mean, in their hundreds, sort of tramping across bridges.
Yes.
with shovels and with rakes and spades and so forth. You know, just clearly they're going to go and try and help clean
Yes.
away some of the mud. But I guess one of the things, lots of people want to help, but it's organizing them. So they go to the places that are, you know, that can use them best.
Yeah. So the part of the organization is, you know, once you kind of see where you have to go, the behind the scenes is tremendous. Like we have a lot of WhatsApp groups, right? And everybody's just trying to communicate through there and updating like what is happening. So there's some groups that have already gone, you know, yesterday, and they're saying, okay, for today, you're going to have to bring this, this, and this. You know, these are the locations we're going to meet because of traffic, right? Like yesterday, they were saying like, you know, we have to meet at this parking lot at this time, which is like an hour away to get into the towns, right? So it's a lot. There's a lot of information that you're trying to sort of minimize and bring it down, funnel it down to get onto the page and say, okay, this is what we're doing, you know? And even at that, there's still a lot of confusion, right? Because the TV is saying, you know, get off the roads and, you know, rain is coming. So people are kind of like, what do we do? What do we do? But at the end, it's everybody's individual choice of how they want to help, right?
Indeed. And I mean, clearly, I realize that you and others are doing it with the best possible intentions. Do you feel that you are doing it, though, in spite of the effort from the authorities or in addition to that?
Yeah, I think that, you know, when you feel like there is no help and you're hearing when the people are getting there saying, we need help, like send the people, go get the water, go get the food, go get the shovels, come down. There is not enough help. There is nobody here. I mean, you have to go against the authorities at that point, you know? It's really sad, but that's the reality. And that's why there's so many people that are not listening and they are going and they're doing. And when you look at the news, what do you see? You see people, you see the Valencian people there, you know? You don't see the military. And I'm hopeful that today is the day that things are going to start changing. But I'm really happy that people are going, you know?
Clearly, it's an absolutely awful story, this Aurora, that, I mean, we now know more than 200 people have died in these appalling flash floods. Can I ask about you? I mean, you decided to move to Valencia just recently. You were telling me before we started the interview you've only been there a couple of months. I mean, it must be a shock to you.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I have my mother that has been telling me about these flash floods. I've only been here for two months. And every time it rained, she would say, hey, listen, there's this thing that happens. Never in my wildest dreams did I really comprehend what that meant. You know, being from Canada, you hear the stories of the storms from the United States, right? From Florida and getting prepared and getting ready and you really live that with them. I never thought that this would happen. And we didn't have the time to get prepared. We really didn't. And now when you're, you know, waking up the next morning and these following days looking at the news, you're just understanding the devastation that has happened. It's nothing prepares you for something like this.
Aurora Iglesias recently immigrated to Valencia from Canada. We do have a live page on our BBC News website, bbc.com/news, including the rather dread news from the mayor of one small town, Chiva, in eastern Spain, saying that many more may yet be found dead inside their cars. From southeastern Spain to western France, where police reinforcements have been sent after a shooting last night sparked a mass brawl involving hundreds of people. The French Interior Minister Bruno Retailleau blamed gangs and their narcotics trade.
These five people injured, these shootings, are not happening in South America. They're happening in Rennes. They're happening in Poitiers, in western France, part of the country that used to be renowned for its tranquility. We are at a tipping point, and I think the choice we have today is between a general mobilization or the Mexicanization of the country.
Catherine Guillardy is a journalist based in Paris. Very striking language from Bruno Retailleau there. What did she make of this term, Mexicanization?
For this new minister for the interior, for him, the drug trafficking is actually the fight against it has to become a national cause. And he calls it a Mexicanization, which is quite provocative indeed. But it's true that drug trafficking in France has changed in the last 10 years. There was five such events, like what happened in Poitiers in 2023. The Minister for the Interior is on his way to Rennes, a town in the west of France, roughly the same size as Poitiers. So we're talking about the main town of what we call a constituency, where a five-year-old child is between life and death after being shot last Saturday as part of a settling of scores linked to drug trafficking. And if you look at a parliamentary inquiry committee that has published its findings last May, Indeed, they say that in the last 10 years, they are alarmed by the spread of the phenomenon to the entire territory. What is new is that it's from medium-sized city to rural areas. And it's particularly bringing spectacular and outbreak of violence and sometimes real scenes of wars. And there are several reasons to that.
Well, I was going to ask you what the reasons are, but it's interesting to hear you say, because I guess, you know, a lot of people listening to this might have thought, well, Marseille down in the southeast, that's had a bit of a reputation for this type of violence. But that sense that it is spreading across the country. I mean, so what is... do you think driving it?
The penetration of drugs in the French territories, as I said, from medium-sized cities to rural areas, has exploded after the COVID. And that, indeed, drugs are no longer, for people in urban areas like Marseille, Lyon, or Paris. The desire to conquer new markets has, in the last 10 years, emerged because the Parisian region, for example, is already cramped. The other thing is what we call Uberization, or you call it like this as well, for drugs as well, meaning that the call centers have emerged and that now you have the delivery of drugs to the homes of customers, even in rural areas. You know, we used to know the bread delivery man or the milkman. Now it's the dealer coming into the countryside. And the other reason, or third reason, is that the police strategy is also pointed at, saying that they have shelled the 4,000 or so dealing points in the country. And that has encouraged traffickers to retreat to the internet. It's true, the phenomenon in smaller cities is what is very surprising and new in France. And the fact, for example, in the Alps, there is a real high-level marketing, says an MP, where you have a sort of graffiti-style thing saying, you know, we are the capital of drugs in some areas, or selling drug bags with Pablo Escobar on it. Mm-hmm. So this is why we hear, he's Colombian, actually not Mexican, but such words in the mouth of our Minister of the Interior.
And given Bruno Retailleau's language, and he's got a bit of a reputation as a hardliner, how do you think that will go down in France? Because, I mean, obviously the police are sometimes seen as being a bit too hardline, a bit too prone to use violence, especially against certain communities. Him talking about a sort of an even heavier crackdown, do you think there will be support for that?
Well, you're right. I mean, we have a right-wing government going towards the far right and has been supported, actually, or actually the far right, the parliamentary from the far right are not doing much thing against this government. So indeed, hearing such vocabulary in the mouth of this man who demonstrated against gay marriage, for example, which was something that showed where he lays, I mean, what his ideas are, is indeed shocking. The problem is that there seems to be at least parliamentary MPs from every kind of parties have published this committee in this inquiry this year, and they say there is a problem. So is it the way to tackle it, to use such strong words? Probably not. But there is a problem, so it needs to be addressed. And maybe the hard line, it hasn't helped. There is something deeper to look at. Yeah, why is it so interesting to do such a business for younger people? People who were shot at in Poitiers are 16 years old.
That was Catherine Guillardy, the Paris-based journalist, talking to me. Just briefly to let you know that we've just uploaded a bonus edition of the NewsHour podcast. You may have heard my colleague James Kumarasamy on air from Wisconsin this week, one of the swing states. He's been travelling around looking at some of the major issues ahead of the election on Tuesday. One that comes up as most pressing for voters is the economy. You won't be surprised about that. You may be surprised that he has found time, though, with his guests to discuss badgers and butter as well. You will get that, and I dare say a whole heap more, on the NewsHour podcast bonus edition. We've just uploaded it. This is NewsHour, live from the BBC. People with psychosis can lose touch with reality. They might hallucinate, see things, or hear voices which others can't. Now an experimental new therapy is delivering impressive results. It involves the creation of digital avatars, digital characters, based on the voices in the heads of the patients, and which they can then confront. Philippa Garrity is Professor of Clinical Psychology at King's College London and the lead author of the study, which has appeared in the journal Nature Medicine.
The way it works is that we discuss with people who hear voices what exactly it is they hear, and we work out to understand where they think the voice is coming from, what the source of the voice, what it looks like. And then with computer software, we sit down with them and we create their own personalized avatar to serve as the source of their voice. That starts with using special software to create the voice as it sounds like the voice that they hear. That software is going to transform the therapist's voice into the sound of the voice that they hear, so that the therapist, in some dialogues, will be able to, as the avatar, be the voice that the person interacts with. Then, after creating the voice, and that's often very successfully done, people say that they find it uncanny how much it sounds like the voice they hear. They create a face. It can be a human face, or it may be a non-human face, like a devilish character. Whatever it is, they imagine their voice looks like. And that then becomes an animated face which speaks, and we enable the person to have a dialogue with their voice, where the focus is on helping people no longer to feel controlled by the voice.
Right. To be very clear about this, is the avatar then, it's not using artificial intelligence to create a conversation with the person. It is the therapist who is, in a sense, yes, having the conversation.
Yes, right. That's right. It's a live voicing of the dialogue, with the therapist choosing what to say. And the way it works is that at the very beginning, the therapist will always use verbatim phrases, phrases that the voice hearer has told the therapist that the voice uses. They have often not explained to anybody what the voice says, because the content is often upsetting or shaming. But in order to establish the real experience of the avatar as their voice, we will use those phrases, and then we will help very quickly people to stand up to and challenge where the phrases are bullying or abusive, which they frequently are in psychosis. And that's the point. People suffer powerful, abusive, controlling voices, and we're trying to help, by having a dialogue, the person to take their own power back and resist the voice.
And I completely conceive the logic of that therapy. What I wonder, though, is whether, in a sense, to come up with this idea and to test it has been a bit of a risk, obviously a calculated risk, because I guess part of you must have been thinking, you know, are we risking sort of giving concrete form to something which is being hallucinated? Could we, in a sense, make it more real for the patient?
The first thing to say is that they are there. Those voices are experienced as real, often omnipresent in the person's life. And in fact, what we found is that people feel empowered by creating this image and sound, which is slightly outside them. They often report feeling that this has given them more power over a thing which actually they are experiencing day by day in their head. The history of working with people with psychosis is that over the past few decades, we used to be told, don't reinforce the voices that people hear by talking about them. That's when I started in my field. And I was part of a movement of psychologists saying, well, they are experiencing these phenomena. We need to understand them better and help them. And what we found is that by creating the avatar, they often feel not that they're making them more real, they're already real, but that they can now look at them in a more dispassionate and controlling way. I think the safety concern we had was not so much making it more concrete by creating the avatar, but that the content of the voices is so often so distressing that we were concerned about exposing people to another context in which they were being faced with the distressing content, and that would this, by being powerful, cause more difficulty.
And when you say them, I mean, the other thing, and obviously I'm no expert here, but I've often heard it said that the people with psychosis hear multiple voices. Is there, are you quite often sort of creating multiple avatars for people?
You're absolutely right that people with psychosis may hear multiple voices. The average is about three, but we ask them for the purposes of the therapy to choose the dominant, most distressing voice. And what we've found is that we can work with one voice and the impact extends and generalizes to the other voices.
Presumably, psychosis is currently tends to be controlled with medication. Is this something that could replace the use of that sort of intervention?
We've done this work alongside medication, and for the present, we think that that's the best option. And in terms of our understanding more generally of psychosis, antipsychotic medication is often helpful, but not always to the extent that is optimal. And running alongside therapeutic interventions like this seems to be best practice to combine the two.
And in terms of you perhaps being able to spread the use of this therapy, and also, I mean, I wonder, it sounds sophisticated, but it doesn't sound like it necessarily might be that expensive, in which case I wonder, and we always ask this question on the World Service, as to whether, you know, we could possibly see this being used internationally.
Well, we're very keen to see how this can be scaled up, and it isn't too expensive. The actual equipment is quite cheap, just a couple of laptops or computers, and the software itself isn't expensive. In terms of international work, there's a lot of interest internationally, and other researchers are conducting studies, and our team, led by my colleague Dr. Tom Ward, is just embarking on a new study to look at a cultural adaptation and test of the therapy in Ethiopia, working with colleagues in Addis Ababa University, and in India, working with colleagues at the New Delhi All India Institute of Medical Sciences.
Just a fascinating piece of research. We wish her and all her colleagues all the best with that new therapy. Philippa Garrity, Professor of Clinical Psychology at King's College London. From all of us on NewsAir, thanks for listening.
With bbc.com/news, you get the latest news stories anytime you like. Whether you're interested in science, health, technology or business, the bbc.com/news website can offer it all. It also gives you the opportunity to listen live to our news output or check the latest breaking news with our minute-by-minute news feed. All this content, coverage and opportunity makes the BBC the world leader in news coverage online. bbc.com/news.
You're listening to the BBC World Service.
Our reporter Kalgida Nibeltal has been following events from neighbouring Ethiopia.
Rupert Wingfield-Hayes reports from the Taiwanese capital, Taipei.
Our Middle East correspondent Yoland Nal sent this report.
The BBC's Nicholas Negos spoke exclusively to the President.
This is the BBC World Service, the world's radio station.